So as Alexander already announced, our today's speaker is Pavel Romanchuk from Berlin. And let me just briefly introduce him to you. He actually studied physics at the Technical University in Berlin. And then he did his PhD in theoretical physics related to active motion and swarming at the Humboldt University. And after that, he did a couple of postdoc stays, the first one at 2011 at the Max Planck. Actually, can you mute, Eduardo? Could you mute your... Yeah, perfect. Thank you very much. So in 2011, he did his first day as a postdoc at the Max Planck Institute for Complex Systems in Dresden, followed by a stay at the Physikalische Bundestechnische Anstalt at the Department of Mathematical Modeling and Data Analysis. Then he moved on to the Leibniz Institute at the Department for Freshwater Ecology and Fish Biology. And in 2014, he went with a prime fellowship to the University of Princeton, where he just, as he told me a minute ago, he just met Ian, who was then at the move to Constance. Since 2016, Pavel is leading an Eminöter, an independent Eminöter group at the Institute of Theoretical Biology at the Humboldt University, where he is now also one of the PIs in the Cluster of Excellence on Science of Intelligence, which, as you can already guess, has a very strong thematical overlap with the cluster we are having here in Constance. So, in short, Pavel's scientific interests are centered around the application of tools in statistical physics and the application of stochastic methods to biological and ecological problems, very similar to the ones we are interested here in Constance. He is particularly interested on how collective behavior is shaped and constrained by locally available sensory information and how to determine and visualize the corresponding information flows between the individuals in animal groups. So even Pavel is working entirely theoretical. He has strong links, strong collaborations with experimental groups, a long-standing collaboration, even back dating back to his time as a PhD group, a PhD to the group of Ian, and he's actually using experimental data as a critical input for his models and to investigate the fundamental properties, but also the limitation of sensory perception in the context of information transfer with collectives. Okay, so Pavel, we are very happy that you could make it virtually under the given conditions to Constance. And we agreed that if you have questions in between, you can always interrupt Pavel during this talk. And we are now looking very much forward to your presentation.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. Okay, so welcome everybody. It's a great pleasure to be given the opportunity to present here my work. And since my links to Ian's group and have been quite old, and already during my PhD, we started collaborating. I know a lot of people, at least from the Max Planck Institute for Animal Behavior, and working with Ian actually know me, maybe from a number of visits to Constance. But today I'm actually also very excited to be able to present my work to a broader audience, hopefully also from people outside of biology who might be interested in this type of research. So the title of this talk is Collective Information Processing. And as Clemens already mentioned, I'm particularly interested in the interplay of self-organization, of self-organized structure, and the function of collective behavior. So maybe just a brief table of contents for what I'm going to talk about today. So I will first give a brief introduction and also state a little bit my broader research interest. But then I will focus on two recent projects that are either just published or just hopefully about to publish in a few months. And they are both theoretically driven. So despite, as Clemens mentioned, my strong interest in connecting to experimental research, and actually in recent years my lab and myself also started to do experiments ourselves, so not only doing theory, and these two projects or these two parts that I'm going to present will be pure theoretical studies or modeling studies. And in the end, I will give a brief summary of the main points of these two parts. So let me jump into the topic. So I'm, as many of you probably are, interested in collective behavior. And if we look in the nature, we see all these beautiful examples of collective behavior on different scales in biology, starting from the smallest scales of bacteria, moving up the scales up to the largest examples of collective migration in nature, which could be locust swarms consisting of millions of individuals spending several kilometers on sites. And as mentioned in the introduction, my background is physics. And coming from physics, you're actually interested, you know, given all this emergent phenomena, are there any universal laws governing the self-organization of the systems? In particular, what could be the laws which differ these new types of active matter, as you would call it in physics, from the classical matter that we know, like, for example, solid states or fluids? So how are maybe these active fluids, if you think maybe of high density suspensions of bacteria, different from normal passive fluids? So this is a strong interest also of mine, really understanding the physics of this large scale collective systems. But what makes me particularly interested in the systems and really excited, and also made me move from pure physics more towards biology, is that these systems actually evolve to be collective. They evolve to fly together, to swim together, as being in a group provided an evolutionary advantage, evolutionary benefits to individuals within the group. And a lot of these benefits can be often associated with collective information processing. So essentially, a fish maybe in such a fish school can profit from the social information provided by others, either signaling, for example, presence of predators or potential information about food locations. And what I'm particularly interested in is to bring these two perspectives together, the one from coming from physics. So what is actually the statistical physics, large-scale behavior of the systems, and how does it interplay with the biological function of evolutionary adaptations that we believe plays a crucial role in the evolution of this collective behavior. So before going to, as I said, two specific examples of my recent research, I just want to give also a bit broader overview of my research interests. So my main research interest, or one of the main topics of my research group currently, is development of agent-based flocking models, or models of collective behavior, which explicitly take into account potential sensory constraints that individuals may exhibit. And in particular, I'm interested in visual interactions. So we have a lot of models in the literature on how collective behavior or collective movement can emerge. A lot of them rely on phenomenological assumptions on social forces, which assume that agents can, for example, recognize and integrate average over the velocity vectors of their neighbors. And here I'm trying to take a step back and ask the question, well, can they do it really? What happens if we just, you know, assume that they have only the visual input, and really what the picture receives on the retina, can they still coordinate emotion, or what information can they draw directly from that, and how can they efficiently coordinate on a global scale? So here's just a very recent work from Renaud Bastien, who was actually in Constance until last year, and myself, which just got published in the beginning of this year. It's about mathematical framework for modeling of agents based purely visual interactions. And I'm very happy and excited about this work that it finally got published, because there we really started from bottom up and came up with a framework how you can actually describe mathematically large ensembles of agents responding purely based on visual interaction. And in a simple scale, as you see in the sketch, you can imagine that the individual in 2D just receives a one-dimensional retinal image, which is basically black and white. There is someone or there's no one. And there's no object recognition, no concept of distance, no concept that maybe other even agents are out there. And still, we could show that with this very minimal model, a vision-based model, you can observe beautiful coordinated movements and patterns that we actually also observe in much more different models or the established classical social force models. But this is just a very recent example of our work. There have been many more papers where I have been actually interested in, can we move beyond the classical social force model? Can we move beyond alignment interactions, which typically assume that the agents can recognize the direction of motion of others? And recently, we also combined this with explicit experiments on fish. Another big research topic, especially recently, is looking at collective escape dynamics in fish as a behavioral contagion, and also on collective decision making, in particular on networks, on distributed spatial systems. And here, a very recent paper that we actually published in collaboration with Ian. This is a PhD thesis of Matt Sosna, who was the lead author on that, and where we contributed some modeling and data analysis to this beautiful work, where we looked how do fish schools actually react to increased perceived risk, how they change their structure. And there we could show that apparently the collective response to risk seems to be fully encoded in a change of the structure and not in an adaptation at the level of individual agents. In this topic of collective escapes and behavioral contagion, we are also actually, as I mentioned, do field research. And this is just a snapshot of a school of Poecilia sulfuraria taken from below the surface. And as you can see, all the fish seem to be nicely located on the surface. And they have to stay there because under the water, they cannot breathe because of sulfur in the water. But there in this system, you can also observe beautiful cascades, beautiful escape cascades, and waves of behavioral contagion spreading, which we can characterize and extend this previous work, which was done in the lab, to actual real ecological setting under real predation. Another topic which I'm still very much interested in is comes from my background in statistical physics. So I'm in general interested in all sorts of large-scale emergent dynamics in biophysical or physical active matter. So how do ensembles of self-propelled particles actually align, or what kind of patterns do they form on the larger scales, and what type of new physics can we observe there? And this is just one example here, this emergence of these vortex arrays in self-propelled particle models, which were motivated by bacterial suspensions. But we also looked at other topics, like, for example, emergent of active smectic order, which is this particular phase known to physics. And last but not least, I'm very much interested in the question how these above topics, which, you know, is this agent is flocking, behavioral contagion, or maybe the emergent dynamics in active matter, how they actually may interplay with evolution and dynamics. So I'm interested in the role of the spatial-temporal self-organization in spatially explicit evolution in games. And this is just one example of some a bit older work, also Ian. This was work by Vishu Guttal, where we explored the evolution of the different phenotypes that you observe in locusts, the solitary and gregarious, based on the local density. And there we could show with mathematical modeling that local social interactions may be actually the one contributing factor to the evolution driving force to develop these two very distinct phenotypes in locusts that were initially believed to be very different species. The solitary ones, which stay on their own, and the gregarious one, which are actually forming this massive outbreaks and massive swarms, which we just also observe right now in Eastern Africa. But there are also other papers. So for example, we looked also at cooperative hunting or proto-cooperation, but also in more general role of evolution of strategies, cooperation and competition, for example, in predator-prey systems or fishing systems. So this is so far for my general research interest. I'm happy also if anyone's interested, maybe in a one-on-one discussion to discuss any of those at some point. But today I would like to focus on two parts as said in the introduction. And the first one will be flocking in complex environment and the what we call coordination versus environmental responsiveness trade-off. This work was done in collaboration with Parisa Rahmani, who was a visiting PhD student in my lab 2 years back. as well as with Fernando Peruani, who is a professor of applied math at the University of Nice. And this paper, or bulk of this work that I'm going to talk about today, was just published one or two weeks ago in PLOS Computational Biology. However, we continued our work on this, so in the end, I will also present some new results which are not yet published. So first of all, the general setup is we are interested in attention trade-offs in collective behavior in complex environments. So just imagine you have this fish here, this focal individual, and we assume that it can pay attention only to few objects in its surrounding. But it can be social cues, it could be other individuals, but also it could be environmental cues, like for example, some features of the environment, like a coral or a plant, which might maybe signal potential dangers as a predator might be hiding there. And the question now is, if we assume that each agent can, for example, visually only pay attention to few or relatively few objects at the same time, how does it affect actually collective behavior? So we are interested in this kind of, are the individuals able to coordinate their motion? How do they respond both to the social and the environmental cues? And the general setup of the model that we came up to study this question was the following. We have a lot of agents, let's say fish, for example, in a complex heterogeneous environment, which may contain a lot of environmental cues. Here indicate this as these little corals or plants, which the individual may each individual may also want to pay attention to. Each agent has a limited attention capacity. It can only pay attention to k nearest object. So irrespective whether it's another individual or whether it's an environmental feature. But all agents try to coordinate the motion with the neighbors they detect within their k nearest object. However, they have also a specific response to these environmental features, and here we assume that they might signal danger. Therefore, each agent tries to avoid a zone around these environmental features. So basically, it's like a simple repulsion mechanism from the center, from this point-like distraction site. However, it only reacts with a response to this distraction site or environmental cue if this is within a certain range, which is really this, in the end, the size of this repulsion zone. And finally, we also add some in-front agents that might know in this complex environment, well, there's actually a correct direction of motion, and this is where we should move. So throughout this talk and this presentation, the right corrective motion will be towards the right, towards the positive X direction. And now the question is, how does this collective behavior, and in particular, the ability of the entire system to follow the lead of the few informed individual, how does it depend on the attention capacity K as a governing parameter governing the response of individuals to social and environmental cues? So first, we can just look at the static interaction networks. So basically, who pays attention to whom at a given time. And there the picture looks as you would expect. So we have here two examples for two different values of K, of the attention capacity. The blue regions represent the avoidance zones around the distraction site, whereas the black little dots are the agents, and black dots are the socially interacting agents, whereas the red dots are the agents who respond directly to the danger sites. Here I should note that once an agent notices a distraction site, so it's within its k nearest objects, and also is within the avoidance zone, then avoiding the distraction site or moving away out of the danger zone has absolute priority, so it ignores other social cues. That's the reason why you see sometimes red dots which are completely isolated. They basically only pay attention now to their environment. But the picture, you know, with respect to K, for low K and high K, looks as you would expect. For low K, you see this very fragmented local clusters or little interaction networks where agents pay attention to each other, but the overall system is not connected because everyone pays only attention to three features, whether it's social or environmental, in their surrounding. So if we increase the attention capacity of agents now to 12, so everyone, every agent can pay attention to 12 objects, then the picture changes dramatically, and we see this giant component emerging where basically this little cutout of a larger system is fully connected. So the interaction network of social interactions between agents basically spans over almost the entire system, with the exception of the few agents that are just isolated because they directly respond to the environment. And now the question would be, you could ask, well, given that some of the agents might have now information about the right direction of motion, which would be to the right here, where would you believe does the accuracy, the collective migration accuracy, is maximized? And the naive or classical assumptions would be that basically when you have a stronger connective network, like here on the right-hand side for the high attention capacity, this is also where the information provided by few informed individual should ideally diffuse through the network, percolate through the network, and therefore you should observe higher migration, global migration accuracy on the right-hand side. And this is actually also what you observe if you assume that you're in an empty environment. So there are no distraction sites, and there are only social cues provided by the agents. And this is actually related to previous work also by Ian, where they looked in leadership in collective behavior. And this is very similar scenario. We have here an empty environment. The only difference is that in our case, each agent pays attention only to few, to K other individuals, whereas in the previous work by Ian and coworkers, each agent looked to a certain sensory range. Nevertheless, what you see if we increase the attention capacity of agents for all ratio of informed individuals in the collective, the accuracy increases. So we see a continuous increase in the global migration accuracy if each agent can pay attention to more and more of its neighbors. So this is as we would expect initially. So larger K, we have a better connected network, and we have a higher global accuracy. But what happens if we now don't look at an empty environment, but an environment actually containing a lot of this distraction side that might interfere locally with the migration process and the collective information process? And then the picture actually reverses completely. Here, with increasing K, we observe for all ratio of informed individuals, we observe a continuous decrease in the collective migration accuracy. And the interesting feature here is maybe to show this for very high attention accuracy, where each agent pays attention to 24 objects in its vicinity. We see that even for a fully informed system, so every agent knows what the right direction of motion is, the accuracy is only about 50-55%, which is lower or comparable to the accuracy for agents with minimal attention capacity, so everyone pays attention only to one object, for a ratio of approximately 2% of informed individuals. So if I have this very the collective with a very limited attention of individual agents, somehow they are very much more capable to accurately follow the lead of the few informed agents than in this high attention capacity case, K24. And this is a really surprising result, because for K24, we definitely have a much better connected network due to the larger K, but lower attention, lower collective accuracy, which is kind of contrary to most results that are, for example, obtained in physics if you look at the synchronization of oscillators on complex networks. How can we understand this? And this, for this, it's best to actually look into the actual examples of such collective behavior. How does it look like? So let's first have a look at a high attention capacity of individuals in a complex environment with a high density of distractions. And now we have on the left-hand side, we have this spatial snapshot, and the red agents are agents that are responding to obstacles, whereas the black agents are the ones that only respond to social cues. And then the bright symbols are actually agents that are informed, or the open symbols, whereas the filled symbols are the uninformed agents. And what you see is that the agents very much align and coordinate their motion locally, but these clusters that emerge there very much respond to the distraction side, to the complex environment, and they basically search the free path through the system while ignoring the preferred direction of motion, which would be here to the right. So there's no, if you now quantify the accuracy, how well they are able to move to the right, you can see that basically fluctuates randomly around zero. So there's the global migration accuracy is basically non-existent. However, the agents are pretty good at avoiding the avoidance zones, the distraction sites. So they are pretty good at staying in the safe regions where we see no blue. This picture dramatically changes if we go now to low attention capacity. So basically to the minimal attention capacity where we have still social interactions. So each agent can pay attention only to one other object, whether it's another individual or whether it's a distraction site. And what we see here is initially, it also looks very much disordered. The spatial distribution of agents looks also already quite different. But what you also see is that individuals are able to coordinate the motion locally, although the clusters that emerge are much, much smaller. Nevertheless, if you wait now long enough, what you see is suddenly that the whole system starts to align with the preferred direction of motion. So there are 10% of informed individuals, as in a previous case, but these 10% are now able to efficiently guide the whole collective along the preferred direction of motion. So in the end, we observe a very high migration accuracy at the global scale. And I forgot to mention here, we use, as often done in such simulation, periodic boundary conditions. So this larger system, each agent who leaves on the right-hand side can re-enter on the left, so that we don't deal with boundary effects. So overall, now the system is very good at migrating at this low k along the preferred direction of motion. But as you already noticed, probably is that basically this individuals run over the avoidance zones. They basically ignore the non-social environment, and their performance in terms of avoiding the obstacles, avoiding the avoidance zones, is actually pretty bad. It's actually worse than solitary agents which would not socially interact, which is the black line at one shown here for normalization. So socially interacting agents at this low attention capacity are basically much worse off than individual solitary agent. And this led us to more systematic investigation. And what we find is that we can quantify this difference between collective accuracy and obstacle avoidance. So if you look at the collective accuracy versus attention capacity, it becomes maximized at low attention capacities. The different curves are now for different obstacle densities, so different complexity of the environment, so to say, with the blue curve being the environment with the lowest number of distraction sites, whereas the purple curve is here with the highest density of distraction sites. But what you can see is for all, as long as we have some environmental distraction sites in the environment, all these curves are basically obtain their maximum at small attention capacity. And if we increase attention capacity further, then the collective migration accuracy decreases. On the other hand, if we look at the distraction site avoidance, how well is the system or are the agents able to avoid these potentially dangerous areas? What we see is that exactly for the low attention capacity, the agents perform pretty poorly, much worse actually than the control, which are the solitary agents now here shown again in solid line. And only above a critical attention capacity, the collective, the socially interacting collective is able to outperform solitary agents. And this holds again for all different obstacle densities. So what we now identified, that there's a fundamental trade-off. You can either coordinate very efficiently for low attention capacity in this complex environment, or you are very good at avoiding the local environmental cues, but not able to globally coordinate the migration for high attention capacity. So we believe that this is maybe a general feature of collective information processing systems, and it might be a fundamental trade-off comparable to speed accuracy trade-off, which is well known and well established also in collective dynamics. In our work, actually based also on reviewer comments, we did a lot of additional modification to test that how robust our results are. and they appear to be very, very robust. So you always observe this fundamental trade-off. For example, you can introduce active signaling of direct responders to the distraction sites. So if an agent starts to avoid a distraction site and move away from an avoidance zone, it can kind of signal to its network neighbors, here's danger, move away. And then we say all the social interaction partners of this direct responder only pay attention to its behavior, to its motion, and align with it. So they effectively also then use social information to potentially avoid this avoidance zone, which they didn't detect yet. And it also holds if we increase the salience of distraction sites. So for example, you argue if it's really such a distraction site signals danger, then maybe agents should be much better at detecting these distraction sites. So we introduce a finite probability of an agent to detect a distraction site completely independent of the social input. And this, you also observe this fundamental trade-off, as long as there is some interplay or interference between social and environmental cues, even if the environmental cues are much more salient. And even if you don't have any preferred direction of motion, you observe this fundamental trade-off, there you need to replace the migration accuracy simply by the random consensus direction that the collective agrees upon. So basically, if there's no preferred direction of motion, no informed individuals, the system picks a certain direction by itself. If you now think of this consensus as a accuracy, you obtain the same trade-off. You can also do other modifications. For example, you can look at structured environments, non-random environments. And here we just put in like a more or less distraction free region in a circular arena, and this is now for high attention capacity again. As what you know, what you see is that the agents realize, even without having global information, okay, there is this empty space, and after a while, with this high attention capacity, they are perfectly, almost perfectly able to stay mostly within the distraction site free, safe circle. However, there are also some informed individuals which still want to move to the right. But at this high attention capacity, the information provided by these informed individuals is completely ignored by the collective. This changes if we look at this low attention capacity case in such a structured environment. Again, this is exactly basically the same scenario, but now the agents seem not to care at all about the structure of the environment, and just start to migrate effectively along the preferred direction of motion, which is again along the X direction. And this shows really nicely in the structured environment how this different attention capacity actually leads to this attention trade-off and this coordination versus responsiveness to environment trade-off behavior. What is the mechanism behind this? There are basically two main possible mechanisms, and both play a role in our case here. What can change with increasing attention capacity is, for example, the ratio of direct responders to distraction sites. So essentially, if I have a higher attention capacity, I'm more likely to detect directly that I'm too close to a distraction site, that I'm within a danger zone. But also there's a second effect that with increasing attention capacity, other individuals who are actually not in an avoidance zone can start to detect, are more likely to detect other agents that actually respond to a distraction site. So that would be like indirect responders through social interactions. They would be the first neighbors of a directly responding individual. And what is shown here is that we can show that with increasing obstacle densities, both effects start to play a dominant role, and this is the blue curves are now for the low attention capacity. There's basically low ratio of direct responders, and there's also a low, even lower ratio of indirect responders, which is completely different for this red curve, which is the high attention capacity, where at the highest obstacle density, basically the direct responders and the indirect responders together already constitute almost the entire collective. So basically everyone is either directly responding to an obstacle or is responding or socially interacting with someone who's responding to an obstacle. But this happens only for this high K, whereas at low K, because of this attentional bottleneck, basically the system self-organize in these little clusters and the attention of individuals becomes saturated by social cues. Because if you move together, you tend to be close to each other, so you're more likely to see other neighbors within your K-nearest object than distraction sites. Okay, we can also look more explicitly now what could be the benefits and costs of the different types of collective information processing. For example, it could be that collective migration yields some benefits, whereas being too close to obstacles yields some costs. So you can ask now for something like a fitness function, which behavior should the collective adopt? And here we just use now a simple global fitness function where we have this very simple two terms. One, C is the collective migration accuracy and A is the obstacle avoidance. And then we have just one single parameter which describes the relative costs or relative benefits of avoidance of this destruction sites versus collective migration. And the function is defined in this way that solitary agents which do not socially interact would yield fitness of zero. So the attention limit now is here on the K, on the x-axis, whereas the relative benefits is now on the y-axis, and the heat map shows this global fitness. And what you see are these two maxima. One maximum at low attention capacity. If migration is much more beneficial than obstacle avoidance, then you should just pay attention to very few neighbors. But if we now increase the costs of being too close to the distraction site or being in the danger zones, then you see that the global fitness decreases. At some point, it becomes the same as solitary agents, and then it actually becomes detrimental to social interact. So you actually perform worse than solitary agents. However, if you now increase the attention limit and you have this very high cost of being too close to the distraction site, you get the second maximum at the high attention capacity. So this two maxima show again this attention, this coordination responsiveness trade-off. So you cannot have both at the same time. But this is now something like group fitness or collective fitness. This is like the optimum at the level of the entire collective. And as biologists, you always start to question, well, but what about actual evolutionary dynamics, which happen at the level of individuals? So this leads me to the project of Saskia Graber, who is a master's student in my group right now, and where we ask the question, is this global optimum actually an evolutionary stable strategy? And instead of a global fitness, we increased individual level fitness. So this is now the fitness of agent I, and it has three contributions. First contribution is that we have some benefits of migration along the preferred direction of motion, and this factor B describes how beneficial this migration is to the individual. Then we have cost of spending time too close to the distraction sites within the danger zones. So this takes into account potential risk, for example, of predation associated with environmental cues. And finally, we add also some costs or potential costs of having a higher attention capacity K. So the more I try to pay attention to others, I might eventually also be forced to invest more into my, let's say, sensing, pay more attention to the environment. Therefore, it might also lead to additional evolutionary costs at the level of individuals. And now we have the three fitness parameters, three benefits, cost parameters, and of course, the overall fitness of agents will depend on the ratio of these three different contributions. And we can change them in our model simulation arbitrarily. And this is just one example of the many effective fitness functions that you get in a homogeneous population, which is equivalent to the case that we had before, if all agents do the same. And you can now see that you can scale now the fitness function from everything which just decreases with K monotonously to something which is the maximum at a finite attention capacity, to something where actually the optimal fitness is achieved for maximal attention capacity. Let's zoom in into just one example of this fitness function. That's here for this benefits of migration 0.5 and the costs of being in a distraction site range of 5. And there we get this fitness function for a homogeneous population. And one can immediately see that this for this particular case, for the intermediate obstacle density, which we look at now, the optimal attention capacity is at 4, approximately. So the population optimum would be for each agent to pay attention to 4 objects in the environment. But is it really the evolutionary stable strategy if we assume individual level adaptation? For this, we use a tool to study this. We use a tool called pairwise invisibility plots. And there's a beautiful paper by Brandstrom and co-workers, which explains the usage of pairwise invisibility plots in adaptive dynamics and evolutionary game theory. And the basic idea is that we assume a resident population of our agents with a certain trait. And we ask now, what is the fitness, the relative fitness of an invading mutant with a different trait given this resident population? And then you can interpret this pairwise invisibility plots in a graphical way. And basically what it shows here is that this cross section in these two regions here, this is the evolutionary stable strategy. To the left and to the right, so if we change the trait of the resident population, then the mutant would have an advantage and would take over the population. But just at this exact point, at this crossing, if the mutant deviates from the trait of the resident population, then it has a lower relative fitness, therefore it cannot invade and take over the entire population. So this is the evolutionary stable strategy. And you can look at different cases, how to interpret different shapes of pairwise invisibility plots to understand different evolutionary outcomes. But for us, the one in the top left is the actually relevant one. These pairwise invisibility plots have been actually developed for as a tool to study analytical models of in evolutionary game theory, but one can use them also to study complex numerical simulation results, and this is what we did here. So this is just such a pairwise invisibility plot for the system that we looked at. Now this is the K, or the attention capacity of a resonance strategy, and this is the attention capacity of a mutant that we may introduce into the system. And one can immediately see here is that the evolutionary stable strategy appears to be here at this crossing between this blue and red regions. So in our case, for this particular parameters, the evolutionary stable strategy is 1. And this is different, much below the optimal attention capacity, which we estimated before from the homogeneous population before. And if we look at the full evolutionary runs now, instead of the pairwise invisibility plots, the prediction is exactly confirmed. So we see that independent on the initial condition in our evolutionary runs, if we let the evolution run for a sufficient number of generations, they all converge to the attention capacity predicted by the pairwise invisibility plot, which is around 1. So now the question is, what happens there? Well, we can, for example, look at the absence of social interactions now, where we can generate the same fitness functions with a maximum at approximately 4, and then look at the pairwise invisibility plots, which is now a little bit more coarse grain shown here. But you can clearly see that the cross section now, the evolutionary stable strategy, is at the same point 4 as now the optimal group level fitness. So basically, the evolutionary stable strategy with respect to attention capacity is the same as the optimal one. If we don't have any social interactions, so the agents just respond on their own to the environmental features. This shows us that in the presence of social interactions, we get something which I like to refer as a strategy of the common information, because it's exactly the same effect as we have in the strategy of the commons. If we start with a homogeneous population at the optimal value, k equals 4, any agent that decreases its attention capacity only slightly can benefit from the social information provided from the others, and therefore outperform in terms of fitness the resident population. And eventually, through this mechanism, the whole population shifts to the evolutionary stable strategy, which is far below the optimal one. Okay, so this is so far for the first part, and I just noticed I'm far out of time, so I will have to move quickly to the second part. Are there any questions regarding the first part right now? If not, maybe the question is, how much time do I have left?
How much you need might be something like 15 minutes. Is that okay?
Yeah, I will try to go quickly in 15 minutes through the next part. And this is the wisdom of stalemates. This is how local consensus may lead to effective filtering mechanism to improve collective accuracy. And this is actually work with a bunch of people, Claudia Winkelmeier, who was a former master student in my group, but is now at the MPI for Mathematics and Sciences Leipzig. And also there's two people here, which some of you might know, which is Albert Kau, a former grad student of Ian, who is now at the Santa Fe Institute, and Joe Beck-Coleman, who is actually, I think, still a grad student with Ian, both at Princeton University, but also probably affiliated with the MPI of Animal Behavior. This is just a preprint that we published online, and we are currently revising this, our manuscript, based on referee comments. So there will be some additional content maybe that is not in the preprint. Let me start briefly with explaining wisdom of crowds. Maybe many of you are definitely familiar with this, so I will just use a very simple working definition. And basically, it says, well, we observe wisdom of crowds if the accuracy of a collective decision increases continuously with group size, and if the collective accuracy is higher than the accuracy of any group member. And there's this classic example by Galton already from the beginning of the 20th century, but also this nice book of Sorovietsky, which discusses different examples of wisdom of crowds. A very classical example is Condorcet's jury theorem, which basically states if you have a jury consisting of individuals which have at least the individual accuracy or reliability of above chance, then if you increase the group size, the corresponding majority decision will approach one, or will approach the perfect decision if the group size goes to infinity. For the wisdom of crowds, we have basically typical assumptions like it's a single shot decision process. So you just make one decision, you gather up information individually, you make your individual judgments, and then you pull the decisions through, for example, the majority rule, or could be also a more general quorum threshold. But it typically assumes that you have all-to-all coupling. There are some newer results that also look at subgroups and networks, but in most of the research on wisdom of crowds, a lot of people look at all-to-all coupling. So the actual motivation for our work here was, on the one hand, a recent paper by Albert Kauer and Ian Cousin on collective decision-making under correlated information, where basically agents could use either a low correlation or independent cue or a high correlation cue to gather information about the environment and to make a decision. And what turned out in a nutshell in this nice study is that in such a complex information environment, the collective decision accuracy is actually not maximized at very large group sizes. So we don't see a wisdom of crowd effect, but it's actually maximized at rather small group sizes. Another study by the group of Gonzalo Polavieja actually looked at something similar but different, where they looked actually how social interactions and kind of sequential decision making by individuals may affect the accuracy of the collective decision. And basically the idea is that each agent watches others making decisions. So if others made a decision before the agent, it is more likely to go with the majority of the other agents that decided already before in a dynamical setting for option A or B. And again, also if you introduce the social interactions, you see that the collective accuracy is also maximized only at small group sizes, so you don't observe wisdom of crowds. So motivated by this, we wanted to ask, well, in both of these examples, agents actually pay attention to the entire system. So this is effectively an all-to-all coupling. What happens if we put this collective decision-making on the network and we allow only for local opinion interactions? So we basically take a Watts-Strogatz network, which is characterized by two parameters, the degree of each agent and the rewiring probability. So it will be a static network. And with this rewiring probability beta, we can scale from a regular graph, which is basically like a line or one-dimensional spatial network, by a small world network to a random, complete random graph. Then we have still a binary decision problem, for example, move left or right, one or zero. And each individual on this network draws initial opinion from the environment, from some environmental cues. But then the actual consensus dynamics happens through asynchronous opinion interactions on a network only with the local network neighbors, according to a simple deterministic threshold model. And the collective decision is reached for one option if the opinion leads to consensus on the network. So this is an example of the how the social interaction works on a graph. So here we have this faint blue agents who interacts with four red agents and one blue agent. And here now the majority of the of its neighbors says blue, whereas this agent, the focal agent, still has the opinion, the majority of agents says red, but the focal agent thinks it should be blue. Because of its majority different opinion, it changes, it updates its opinion to red. On the other hand, we have an example where no update takes place. So here we have a focal agent which thinks it should be red, but then half of its agent think it should be red, but the other half should thinks it should be blue. So there, among its neighbors, there's no actually clear majority for one or the other option. So it's a 50-50. In this case, the agent doesn't update its information. And in this kind of local information dynamics, you can actually have networks which can lead to stalemates. And this is the most minimal example that you can imagine of a stalemate. For example, no agent will switch an opinion in such a network, because for all the agents which are connected to agents with differing opinion, there's another agent that counterbalances the differing opinion. And now we can look what happens to consensus decision through this local network interactions. And what we could show is that actually, if we look at the consensus decision on a network, it outperforms Condorcet's jury theorem. And this is shown here in this plot. So this is now for some reliability of individuals 0.55. So they are not very reliable, but they are slightly above chance. And Condorcet jury theorem would predict the gray curve here, which is basically the accuracy of the initial guess if we just pull it by all-to-all majority decision. And the red symbols now reproduce the outcome of the local network opinion consensus. And what we see is that the consensus decision is already at smaller group size outperforms the Condorcet or the simple majority vote. This difference vanishes if we consider higher reliability of individuals, and basically there's a still small effect, but they're very much fall on top of each other. And where does this increased consensus accuracy in the local network comes from? Well, it actually comes from the probability that a network converges to a consensus based on the initial votes. And this is for different group sizes. And blue means that I converge to the blue option, which is the correct option in our case. And red means that the network or any network converges to the wrong option. And what you can see is that basically for small groups, you can get very random sampling. This is basically the histogram shows the probability of all agents in a group or the distribution of initial opinions of all agents in the group. And if we increase the group size, it becomes more and more accurate. The reliability is this dashed line here. So for large groups, we see this more or less nice normal distribution around the reliability of individuals. But what you can see is that for most of these initial conditions or initial votes by the individuals, the consensus algorithm will lead to a stalemate. And only those that already are on the right direction will actually converge to the right direction, to the right option. So basically the stalemate here acts as a filtering mechanism, just says, well, the initial vote was not very reliable. We are stuck, we don't know what to do more. So essentially, the stalemates act as a decision filters. And this holds also if you now go to the context information environment, where in addition to an independent queue, you also have a correlated queue, as in the previous study by Albert Kao and Ian Cousin. And there, the initial this vote distribution of individual agents looks slightly different. There, it actually becomes bimodal. And these two maxima are actually conditioned depending on the value of the correlated queue. So if the correlated queue, which is basically means that all agents that listen to the correlated queue receive the same information queue at the same time, if this information queue is incorrect, then you get this, basically you land in this part of the distribution. Where the initial queue is correct, then you land in this second peak, which is closer bias to the right option. And now it even nicer exemplifies this filtering mechanism through the stalemates, because basically it completely filters out this bad peak, whereas it lets through most of the time the good peak, in this complex information environment with correlated queues. And we can study this much more thoroughly for all sorts of parameter ranges. I don't want to go more into detail because of the lack of time. But essentially, what it shows is that even in cases where you would have no wisdom of crowds, the consensus mechanism in local networks rescues the wisdom of crowds. So with increasing group size, if the network converges, it will converge very reliably to the right option. And you can study all sorts of different network parameters, how the network structure affects the collective accuracy. But the main take-home message here is that there's actually no free lunch. What you observe is that the probability of a stalemate increases strongly with group size. So yes, the networks that converge to the with high accuracy to the right option outperform simple majority rule. But a lot of times, you're actually stuck in a stalemate in this situation for large networks. So, and if you decrease the stalemate frequency, for example, by changing the network parameters, then you also decrease these accuracy gains due to the local network interactions. However, there are ways out of this. You can, for example, say, instead of having full consensus necessary for collective decision to be made, you can just say, okay, we have some imperfect consensus. Let's say 80% of the individuals have to agree. And you still see pretty well accuracy benefit through the local interactions. Or you can ask, how can you escape a stalemate? And a stalemate could basically tell you, well, your initial information for the collective is not good. We should redraw some information. So each agent goes to the environment, looks at environmental cues again, and then we proceed further with the local interaction mechanism. And what you can see here is that, for example, if you take global redraws at the whole network redraws, then you just need one or two global redraws to resolve a stalemate and with high accuracy converge to the right option. So in the end, what will be the optimal behavior will, of course, depend on the cost and benefits of deciding for the correct option or the costs of actually making the wrong decision as a collective. But also something which I didn't speak about so far, what happens if the stalemates might be costly, because they might mean, for example, temporal cost as the group cannot decide whether to go left or right. And of course, then the optimal behavior of the group will be determined of this different ratio of these different costs and benefits. Because of the lack of time, I don't have to go time to go more into detail. So let's come to the summary of the two parts. So in the first part, I talked about this coordination responsiveness trade-off, and especially how limited attention can enhance global coordination through self-organized isolation from disrupting environment, and also that actual evolution dynamics leads to something which I refer to as strategy of common information. In the second part, which you just heard, I briefly browsed through our recent paper on how stalemates may have actually a function in collective decision making and may act as filters to filter out unreliable initial environmental sampling by the members of the collective. And that's the end. Thank you very much for, I should thank my collaborators who were involved in this study and also the different funding bodies. But in particular, I thank you for being so patient with me and for listening to this online talk.
So thank you very much, Roman, to this very nice talk. I see here a lot of response already.
Thank you for the interesting talk. A lot of this has brought me back a little bit to like attentional studies that you see in rodents and primates when it's visual attention. And when you talk about limited attention for the individual, I mean, I'm wondering if you have taken into account the so far two primary or two known attention systems, spatial attention versus feature-based attention, where you either restrict your attentional focus on a given, like a flashlight, kind of a zoom-in area, versus if you think of a feature, the color red, you try to find your best friend as a football game. You know he's wearing a red shirt and everything that is red is highlighted, so you have a much broader kind of sense, but given at that point, sacrificing the real local one, for instance, if you know he's going to sit in block C and come down these stairs, if something like that has been actually accounted for in your model. As I wonder, since it's all individual brains still functioning as a collective, then if individual brain mechanisms play then a role in the model as well for the collective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. This is an excellent question. So we are kind of really coming from this kind of macro scale collective behavior literature. So of course we try to model the individual agents very simple, you know, in a simple possible way. But we are definitely inspired also by the known results on how many emotion cues apparently a human can track simultaneously. And if you want to coordinate the emotion, you would believe that you somehow need to also track which direction are your neighbors moving to. And from human psychophysics experiments, at least, it's believed that they can pay attention to 4 to 6 objects in their short-term memory, to this dynamical cues. But of course, you are right. We have, you know, humans, but also vertebrates, and also most biological creatures are much more complicated than this, and they have different machineries for different types of attention. And so what I believe is that our model doesn't say, well, that's the only type of attention they have. Just shows that depending on the ecological context, you might need to shift between different attention capacities, and maybe the different machineries are actually responsible to having more like a broad attention to many objects or more focused attention for coordination. And at least what we believe is like a first step to maybe look at this kind of how the ecological niche might or the current context might shape what type of attention you should use. And so I definitely believe that in humans or animals definitely dynamically can also shift and allocate or increase and decrease their attention capacities. For example, you can think of a flow phenomenon in humans. So if you really concentrate on a task, you're really coordinating, kind of synchronizing with it, and then you basically completely forget what's around you. But then something brings you out of this and suddenly you cannot concentrate as much at this anymore. So I think it's also like a kind of an example of a kind of coordination now with a task and responsiveness trade-off. So either I can do one thing very good, or I can pay attention to the broad environment. I cannot do both simultaneously. And this is, I think, why I personally believe this seems to be a more general feature. But of course, we just made a first step coming from a more modeling flocking behavior literature, and I would be very excited to work in the future more with psychologists to see, for example, in humans, what type of attention mechanism and shift in attention we might have in this kind of complex scenes. And I've been discussing this a little bit with some experts on active vision, Martin Rawls, who is in our excellence cluster, but this was just first discussion for now. I just hope we can continue this in the future.
So I don't spot other questions. So maybe I can ask one in the meantime by myself. Of course, vision is just one example of social interactions. So in particular, when it comes to this collective accuracy, depending on the attention capacity, how transferable are those results to might be chemotactic response? Is that specific to vision?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question, and I've been wondering about this also, although probably I should think more about this. So chemotaxis I find particularly interesting because it's a kind of scalar information that is provided in the sense that it typically informs about concentrations. Of course, you can, if you have temporal sensing or spatial sensing, you can also estimate gradients from concentrations. However, this gradient information might be also very limited or very noisy. So short answer is, I don't know. I think there might be some trade-off if you now really think about, for example, the cellular signaling machinery, and depending, for example, what type of cues you might have, chemical cues in your environment, which could be provided from other agents, like bacteria extract, for example, metabolic products, which can be chemoattractants to other agents, versus chemical cues which might come from the environment. For example, signal potential food that is diffusing through the, or potential food source that is diffusing through the environment. And then if you have the same machinery, the same receptors on a bacterium that actually respond to both agents simultaneously at the same time, then I would expect you will see similar trade-off, although different. Of course, it won't be now a kind of alignment motion, but it would be rather whether I aggregate to form a quorum, a bacterial quorum, or whether I'm able to find the food spots.